Tonight we've got another question, and this one is really, I guess, kind of a, as I read it, I thought someone is struggling in this congregation, and I'm going to just share with you what they had written. I have a lot of trouble with all the heartache and troubles people have. Same things are out of balance, rich people and all the people who struggle so hard. The homeless, I really struggle with faith. It is so hard for me. You know, not everyone that walks in these doors just has everything together. Many of us, if we are honest with each other, would say, you know, we struggle. We struggle from day to day with things going on in our lives. And I heard a preacher one time talk about how what it's really like on a Sunday morning. Mom and Dad are yelling at each other, trying to get the kids out the door. Kids are fussing and griping and complaining with each other and picking at each other. And they get each other in the car and all this fussing and complaining all the way to the building until they get to the church parking lot. And then they get out and Dad fixes his tie and buttons his coat and everybody walks in like nothing's wrong in the world, when in reality everything is wrong. Well, I'm going to try to do my best. I'm not sure if I'll answer this question in a way. I'm hoping that what I will say will help the individual who has asked it. But I want to begin, first of all, with just acknowledging that things are messed up in the world. But it didn't start that way. And that's what I want you to know. It didn't start that way. If you go back to Genesis chapter 1 and you began reading through that chapter about God's creation of everything that we see around us, there's a phrase that is continually repeated. As God finishes part of His creation each time, it will say, "And God saw that it was good." In other words, God gave His stamp of approval upon His creation. It was good. And when finally He created man, as you see here in verse 31, God saw all that He had made, and behold, it was very good. So in the beginning, everything was very good. It wasn't what we see today. Far different. But then something changed. Man sinned, and everything changed from there on. If you go back and you look at the sin that took place in the garden as it is recorded for us there in Genesis chapter 3, and then finally God's curse upon this world, we find this statement, "Cursed is the ground because of you," that is, because of Adam and Eve's sin, specifically Adam, "in toil you will eat of it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles. It shall grow for you, and you will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you will eat bread till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return." I heard one person say one time, "You know, if I could go back and talk to Adam and Eve, I think I'd try to talk them out of doing what they did." Because one thing this person said is, "I hate mosquitoes." But, you know, we live in a world that is far from what it originally was when it was created. God has cursed this world, and because of that curse, we live in a creation that, according to the Apostle Paul, is actually struggling in what he calls a type of bondage. In Romans chapter 8, there beginning in verse 19, he says, "For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of Him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain what he calls the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now." That's the English Standard Version's translation of that passage. But the point that Paul makes is everything we see around us is actually in a type of bondage. It's a bondage to this curse that God has placed upon the world as we know it today. And it is longing to be set free from that curse, but until the time of the redemption of the sons of God, of God's children, it's going to continue on even as it's been. And so because of that, the world is not what it once was. It's not the beautiful place that God originally created and said it is good, and even said it's very good. But then again, neither are we. As a matter of fact, one of the things that Paul also brings out in this same chapter, if you back up a few verses, back to verse 5, he talks about those who live according to the flesh. And he tells us what they struggle with. He says, those who live according to their flesh set their minds upon the things of the flesh. And he tells us there's a contrast. There, those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. So you've got those who are living according to the flesh, the ways of the world, he said their mind is focused on that. Those who set their mind on the Spirit, their mind is focused on this over here. Well, that tells you already there's going to be this constant battle between the two ends. Those focused on the Spirit, those focused on the flesh. We see that in our society today. But then he goes on to say, to set the mind on the flesh is death. But to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace. So those who've set their mind on the flesh, ultimately eternal death and damnation. Those who've set their mind on the Spirit, there's life and peace. Not in just in what is to come, but I believe also in this world. Do you sense a frustration around us in our world today? I think that frustration, that shortness of temper, that willingness just to lash out, the shooting that took place last week in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the police chief said they were surprised at the response, at what happened as a result of that. But you see, in this country, what we're seeing, and not just in this country, the world over, we're seeing this shortness of people's patience anymore. People are ready just to light into someone if you say the wrong thing to them. Why? Because there's no longer a focus on the things of God. I believe that's the reason anyway. And as long as people are just out for one another and they're not focusing on the things of God, they don't have peace inside. There's no contentment. There's no long suffering. There's no joy, not true joy. Love, it's just a word. And so that's what's going on. And he goes on in the next two verses, verses 7 and 8, to say that the mind that is set on the flesh is hostile toward God. Well, we're seeing that. There's a hostility in this country toward the things of God like we haven't seen since as far back as I can remember. And I know I'm not as old as many of you in this room. But they're hostile toward God. And not only that, he says, the mind set on flesh does not even submit to God's law. He says it cannot submit to God's law. Those who are of the flesh or in the flesh cannot please God. So here's where I'm going with all of this and trying to answer this question. Why are things in the mess that they are? Why does there seem to be all of this, that this person that has written this question brings out? Number one is because you go all the way back to the sin in the garden, and everything around us, all of creation, has been placed under this curse by God. And then not only that, you've got, as a result of that, sin which has come into the world, and you've got a division. You've got those who set their minds on the things of the Spirit and those who set their minds on the things of the flesh. And those who set their minds on the things of the flesh, what the world says is enticing and good and pleasing, they can't please God. They're hostile toward God, and they cannot even submit to the law of God. If anything, they're destined for death. And they have just an anger inside of them. It's almost like you've got so many people walking around with this chip on their shoulder just waiting for someone to knock it off. And because of that, I think we have all these problems in the world. But then let me share something else with you. Man's lot in life. You go back to Job. Remember Job, richest man in the East, had everything any man could want materially, was blessed by God, and yet after losing it all and then finally being afflicted physically by Satan, he makes this statement. He said, man who is born, or man is born for trouble as sparks fly upwards. You know, the sparks that come out of a fire, they kind of fly up. He said, man is destined for trouble from birth. And then in chapter 14 in verse 1, he kind of reiterates it. Man who is born of woman is few of days and full of trouble. Job's take on it all is, that's our lot in life. Trouble with a capital T. Well, you look at something that Solomon wrote in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. He says, for what does a man get in all his labor and in his striving with which he labors under the sun? Because all his days his task is painful and grievous. Even at night his mind does not rest. It's to his vanity. You see, when you look at the book of Ecclesiastes, as Solomon is writing, it's like he conducts this major experiment trying to find out what satisfies in life, what truly brings pleasure and joy and contentment, and his answer is nothing. Nothing. All is vanity and striving after the wind. But then he comes to the end of the book, and you know what he says? When you hear the conclusion of the matter, fear God, keep his commandments. Why? This is the whole duty of man. This is what makes us complete. I'm going to add one more thing, and then I'm going to try to bring all of this together. The person that asked the question talked about the rich and the poor, call them the homeless. One of the things I have learned in my few years upon this earth is this: the rich and poor will always be among us. You'll never get rid of those who are rich. There will always be rich people in this world, and that's a good thing. And there will always be poor people in this world. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but that's just a truth. You will always have poor. The poor people have been with us since man walked upon the earth, since the first of the civilizations began cropping up. If anything, one of the things that God commanded his children, Israel, to do was to recognize and take care of the poor. That's why they had the law of the gleaner, which meant that you were not to reap your crops out to the edge of the fields. You were to leave it, and whatever fell to the ground, you didn't automatically get up on the first pass through, you didn't go back and clean it up. You left it for the poor. Remember the book of Ruth? That's what she was doing. She was gleaning. She was picking up what had been left over or left behind by the harvesters. They were to do that with their fruit trees, all of that. Why? To provide for the poor. God has always expected his people to make allowances and to care for and to reach out and try to help those who are poor. And so that is one thing. But we'll always have both among us. Now, that being said, we've got to be careful. Let me back up to this other statement. We must be careful that we do not judge others as good or bad simply because they are poor or rich. You know, sometimes we'll something, and that's where it seems that some of our society is going today. Well, if you're rich, you've got to be a bad person. You got your money by walking over other people. And the other side of it is, if you're poor, you're just a lazy person. You just don't work. And neither of those are true 100% of the time. There are rich people that are good people. And as a matter of fact, if you look in Scripture, a lot of God's faithful people were wealthy. You can look at the Scriptures. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph. Now Joseph started out rich, I guess you might say, because he was the son of Jacob. But then he ended up in prison and had nothing. And then the next thing you know, he's elevated to number two in all of the kingdom of Egypt at that time, second only to Pharaoh, so he's back wealthy again. Job is listed as being the richest man in the East. David, if you go back and look at his blessings by God and also at the amount that he gave to the temple in preparation for its building, he was wealthy. And this is just from the Old Testament. We could look at others in the New Testament as well. There are good, rich people in the world. Caring rich people that use what God has blessed them with to do good for others. And we need to always be careful that we don't just lump all of them together. Now, I realize, having said that there are those who are wealthy that have used their wealth First of all, they trust in their wealth. And secondly, they sometimes have used their wealth to oppress others. I know that's true. I wasn't born yesterday. I know that there are both sides to that. As a matter of fact, one of the things that Paul wrote to Timothy is he said, I want you to be careful. Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. You know, be careful about just the desire to be wealthy. I want to be wealthy. I want to be wealthy. Because then you may choose a path in life that may not lead you close to God, but further away from Him. And then further down in that same chapter, he taught Timothy. He said, I want you to instruct the rich, who are those who are rich in this present world, not to be conceited. In other words, don't go around with your nose up in the air. I once heard a man say that the only reason that women have their nose up as they're driving a Cadillac is because they can't see over the hood. I don't know. But he said, don't be conceited. Or to fix your hope on the uncertainty of riches. Oh, how true that is. We all know people that when the bubble burst back around 2000, lost a lot, and they've had to rebuild it and get it back, and then again in 2009. Don't fix your hope on the uncertainty of riches. What do you fix your hope on? Wealthy and poor alike, you fix your hope on God. God who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. Isn't that true? It's God who gives us everything we have. Every good and perfect gift, James said, comes down from the Father of lights, in whom there's no variation or shadow of turning. And that being said, the poor, or, well, excuse me, there were those, I'm skipping over something I meant to bring out, and that is there are those who are rich in the world that have used their wealth, their power, to suppress and to harm the poor. I mean, it's been that way down through history. But in Isaiah's day, God had him speak to those who were wealthy and had power. And he said, woe to those who enact civil evil statutes and those who constantly record unjust decisions so as to deprive the needy of justice and rob the poor of my people of their rights so that widows may be their spoil and that they may plunder the orphans. Yes, there are those who use their wealth to take from others because they can do it. I know that. Then the poor. Many of God's faithful were poor. I believe Elijah was a poor person. He was a prophet of God. He lived, as you notice from chapter 17 of 1 Kings, he lived for a while by a brook with the ravens feeding him. God was caring for him. Elisha left what he had in order to follow Elijah and to become a prophet. Joseph and Mary, we know they were poor because of the sacrifice they offered at the temple for Jesus. It was the sacrifice stipulated in the law for poor people. And Jesus himself, birds of the air have nests, foxes have holes, the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. He didn't even own his own home. All he had when he died were the clothes on his back. And then Paul. I think Paul had money at one time. But whatsoever things were considered gain for me, these I count as loss for the sake of Jesus Christ. He left it behind to follow Christ. Even when you come to Philippians 4, he talks about how to get along with abundance and how to get along with very little. So there were poor people following Christ. There are poor people down through history that have been faithful servants of God. Now, bringing all that together, how does that deal with what this individual asked? You know, I struggle with what's going on in the world. Folks, I'm going to say this. These things are going to continue to happen as long as you and I live. We're going to continue to see injustice around us. We're going to continue to see good people suffer. And bad people seem to prosper. But that should not hinder us. And this person was struggling with their faith. And here's why I say this. First of all, I want you to know that God is aware of everything that goes on in His creation. There is nothing that escapes His notice. As a matter of fact, there are four passages I want to share with you. Here's two of them. Psalm 33, verse 18. David writes, "Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear Him, on those who hope for His loving kindness." And then in chapter 34, Psalm 34, verse 15, "The eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and His ears are open to their cry." God pays attention to His people. He knows what you go through. He knows your struggles. You are not alone. I like that song we sometimes sing, "I don't know about tomorrow, but I do know who holds tomorrow in His hand. I don't borrow from the sunshine." You know, we trust in God. And then these other two passages, Proverbs 5, verse 21, "The ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord. He watches all his paths, and the eyes of the Lord are in every place, watching the evil and the good." So what do we do? Well, I'm going to share with you two last passages. One is this one. It's one that I know is Reed's favorite. Proverbs 3, verses 5 and 6. "Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not upon your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will direct your paths." Or He will, as the New American Standard says, He will make your paths straight. But then the other passage, and I hope that you brought your Bibles, is Psalm 37. And the reason I chose this to end with is because David is struggling with the same thing that the person who wrote this question is struggling with. It just is hard to live in this world when I look around me and I see injustice and I see people who seem to be prospering and they're doing wrong and I'm trying to do right and it doesn't seem like I'm getting ahead or it doesn't seem like things are going my way. I want you to listen to what David writes. David says, "Do not fret because of evildoers. Be not envious toward wrongdoers. For they will wither quickly like the grass and fade like the green herb. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land and cultivate faithfulness. Delight yourself in the Lord and He will give you the desires of your heart. Commit your way to the Lord. Trust also in Him and He will do it." Now this is the way he begins. But look in verse 6. He says, "He will bring forth your righteousness as the light and your judgment as the noonday." He goes on to say, "Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for Him. Do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who carries out wicked schemes. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret. It leads only to evil doing. For evildoers will be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord, they will inherit the land. Yet a little while and the wicked man will be no more, and you will look carefully for his place and he will not be there. But the humble will inherit the land and will delight themselves in abundant prosperity." He says, "The wicked plots against the righteous and gnashes at him with his teeth. The Lord laughs at him, for he sees his day is coming. The wicked have drawn the sword and bent their bow to cast down the afflicted and the needy, to slay those who are upright in conduct. Their sword will enter their own heart. Their bows will be broken." He says, "Better is the little of the righteous than the abundance of many wicked, for the arms of the wicked will be broken, but the Lord sustains the righteous. The Lord knows the days of the blameless, and their inheritance will be forever. They will not be ashamed in the time of evil, and in the days of famine they will have abundance. But the wicked will perish, and the enemies of the Lord will be like the glory of the pastures. They vanish like smoke, they vanish away. The wicked borrows and does not pay back, but the righteous is gracious and gives. For those blessed by him will inherit the land, but those cursed by him will be cut off. The steps of a man are established by the Lord, and he delights in his way. When he falls, he will not be hurled headlong, because the Lord is the one who upholds his hand. I have been young," can you say this? "I have been young and now I'm old, yet I have not seen the righteous forsaken or his descendants begging bread. All day long he is gracious and lends, and his descendants are a blessing. Depart from evil," young people listen to this, "depart from evil and do good, so you will abide forever. For the Lord loves justice and does not forsake his godly ones. They are preserved forever, but the descendants of the wicked will be cut off. The righteous will inherit the land and dwell in it forever. The mouth of the righteous utters wisdom, and his tongue speaks justice. The law of his God is in his heart. His steps do not slip. The wicked spies upon the righteous and seeks to kill him. The Lord will not leave him in his hand or let him be condemned when he is judged. Wait for the Lord and keep his way, and he will exalt you to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, you will see it. I have seen a wicked, violent man spreading himself like a luxuriant tree in its native soil. Then he passed away, and lo, he was no more. I sought for him, but he could not be found. Mark the blameless man. Behold the upright. For the man of peace will have a posterity, but transgressors will be altogether destroyed. The posterity of the wicked will be cut off, but the salvation of the righteous is from the Lord. He is their strength in time of trouble. The Lord helps them and delivers them. He delivers them from the wicked and saves them because they take refuge in Him. Did you hear what David said? He said, the wicked are going to eventually be cut off by God. Oh, they may have their day now, but God will cut them off. But those who trust in Him, the righteous, those who follow His ways, those who are faithful before Him, He will uphold them. He will sustain them. They take refuge in Him. He will see them through to the end. Be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of righteousness. That's what Jesus said. And I guess that's what I'm saying in all of this. I can't change everything going on in this world. I have no control over any of you. And I struggle with control over me. But you know, the one thing I do know is that if each of us simply strives to be God's person, to honor Him, to trust Him, even when we don't seem to see how all of this is going to play out, I firmly believe, that He will see us through. He will strengthen our hearts, and He will keep our souls. And in the end, that's what really matters anyway, isn't it? Tonight, if you're not a Christian, I want to encourage you to follow Jesus. You know, Ray Song, I have decided to follow Jesus. Would you do that? Would you decide tonight, I want to follow Him. I want to be His. This morning, Barbara said, I want to do that. And she put her Lord on in baptism. Maybe that's what you need to do tonight. To confess the name of Jesus. To turn from your sin. To be buried with Him in baptism. And then to follow Him the rest of your days. And maybe you're here tonight and you're just not a Christian. You are a Christian, but you know I haven't done what God wants. Wouldn't it be nice just to come back home and say, Lord, can I start again? Will you give me a second opportunity? Because God gives mulligans. As long as we live, He'll let us start over. This song may be for you. And if it is, the rest of us are singing to encourage you. And so God invites you, please, will you come as together we stand and sing.